Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 79, featuring Lisa Beru, who until very recently was the executive producer in charge of feature production over at Digital Domain. She's no longer there. She left recently. She's going to an undisclosed location. But she was a fantastic person that I work with at Digital Domain, and Stephen is joining me for the podcast. In fact, you and I first worked with her on Tron. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
So tell people some of your impressions of Lisa, because I'm sure they echo mine.
They were the best run shows that I was on.
Right.
Were Lisa shows.
Yeah.
And she's a rare breed of producer.
Yeah.
And I think that even despite, I think people start out with the best intentions when they become producers, but after a number of years, just get kind of worn down by the process. And I think that people, it's easy for somebody to sort of start to distance themselves from the people underneath them,
mm-hmm.
because it makes it easier for them to make tough calls.
Yep.
And I never got that sense from Lisa. She was always very involved with the people, not even directly reporting to her, but like everybody,
right.
On the show. And she was, and you just got this sense that, she was also personally interested in your well-being as well as, just trying to listen to everybody, so that she can make informed decisions about things.
And she never made you feel nervous. Like when things were going really wrong, she was always very calm. And she made you feel like everything was going to be okay. She's very, very soft-spoken. When she says things, and you'll notice it on podcast, she doesn't talk that much. But whenever she says something, she's always like exactly to the point and,
right.
and puts her position in there. And it's never really convoluted or, about her ego or anything. She has she has no ego.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably her best qualities, that even if she was so insanely stressed out herself personally,
right.
She never projected that onto anybody or not, and always just seemed to have a really level head.
Did you know that she was on a heart monitor at the end of Tron?
Yeah, see, no. I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah, but she no one knew it. She always made it like, oh, well, Lisa is not panicking, so I'm not panicking.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but it works, right?
Yeah.
But like, I guess you're also internalizing things too. But anyway, I'm just saying like there are easier ways to produce, and
yep.
she is a hardworking producer.
Yeah. Yeah. She's really, really fantastic, and I love having a conversation, and I consider her a very good friend of mine, so I'm very happy about that. Just a couple of quick announcements. We will be at SIGGRAPH, as you guys know, as I've been trying to let you guys know that. We will have V-Ray days on Tuesday and Wednesday of SIGGRAPH. We won't have a booth, but we'll have a lot of great presentations at V-Ray days. So make sure and check those out. We will have a website out that will have all of the schedule and everything for you guys to register, et cetera, et cetera. So make sure and check that out. We look forward to seeing you guys at SIGGRAPH. Oh, yeah. Forgot one other big news that happened this week. V-Ray for Moto. V-Ray for Moto came out.
That's right.
And so it's now official. You can go out there and buy V-Ray for Moto. So go look into it. If you guys are Moto users and you want to try to use V-Ray and Moto, it's a fantastic choice. And I think it looks really, really good. It's a really well-done integration into that package. So love to hear your feedback on that and let us know what you think. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
I don't even edit them because I don't have time. So people hear me drinking coffee and it's fine.
I just heard you slurp.
Yeah. Yeah, you can hear me slurp. I do this sound too.
I want to do it now too.
Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Ah, that's
good. It's pretty good microphones, huh? They pick up everything.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I was looking at your IMDb page for just before here, and I was sort of looking at it, and I realized your IMDb page starts with Zodiac, but you've been doing this way longer than Zodiac in terms of producing and all that other stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And back in the 90s, you were a line producer for a long time, mm-hmm. right?
I started in the mid-80s in New York City.
Yeah?
At a small commercial production company when it was really fun to make commercials and there was lots of money and yeah.
Was it post-production or was it?
Live action.
Live action. And what kind of commercials were you doing? What kind of?
You know, car commercials and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
Probably cigarette commercials.
Yeah.
Perish the thought.
So, yeah. So a little bit Mad Men-like, but in the 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard stories of the 80s in the commercial world and lots of cocaine being handed around and stuff like that.
Yeah. New York City in the 80s, it was really exciting.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's not like that anymore. And creativity was the most important thing. And
well, they had enough money to be patient for creativity.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I let that happen naturally. It wasn't sort of. The return on investment was not necessarily a word back then, right?
Well, I, you know, commercials were aired differently and
thought
of differently.
And there was a lot more viewers, right?
Yeah. So there wasn't as much control over deciding not to watch them. So
right.
Now they're just not very watchable.
Yeah. It's true.
Sad.
I actually don't. So recently I untethered. I don't have cable in the house. I don't have satellite. So we just have Netflix and Hulu, and then we opted on Hulu to just remove the commercials for an extra $4. So we don't see commercials at all. And I just realized when I go to like a restaurant or a bar or whatever, and I see something on TV, like, oh, a commercial. It's kind of a weird thing. Like I don't mm-hmm. see commercials that much. The only time I see them beyond that is like maybe I see a 5-second thing before YouTube, you know, or
mm-hmm.
something like that. So it's got to be hard.
Yeah.
It's got to be hard.
It's a decimated business, it seems
yeah.
to me.
Yeah.
From the outside now.
But okay. But so you were doing commercial work and then you got into, I saw you were at A52 for a few years too, right?
I was at, I did a short film
uh-huh.
with Vicki Jensen.
Yeah.
Who directed, was one of the directors on the first Shrek, and then she was a director on Shark Tale.
Oh, okay.
And then we made a live-action short film that was about 35 minutes.
Oh, that's not so short.
Where we all emptied our houses of all our furniture and...
Yeah.
Anyway, it was made on the cheap, and that won a lot of awards. And then,
uh-huh.
yeah, then after that I
Were you a producer on that?
Yeah, I produced it.
Okay. Before we move on from that, because you were very instrumental to me in helping me trying to produce the V-Rite IRL short, because
mm-hmm.
you'd obviously known about some of the stuff. And I kind of accidentally became a producer on that thing. I didn't know about what it was or how it was going to be. And Dan Thron was directing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't even want to be a producer. And he looked at me and he says, listen, no, being a producer is awesome. It's really cool. It's like, and it's actually very creative. And I thought, you know, it just doesn't seem that way. It seems like the director has a full creative control and the producer just sitting there holding the purse strings and making sure everything's actually happening. And it's like, that's not actually the case. There is a lot of decision making that affects creative decisions that come from the producer that are, you know, that are beneficial. And I learned that from you and from Dan, and it was really kind of cool. You really helped me a lot. And I remember going to your office and going, I get it now. I understand how hard this is. And it was, I don't know, I really loved it. And I think Dan was still trying to convince me for a while to just give up my VFX career and just become a live-action producer. But I don't know. I still think it's cool. And I learned a lot from you at that point.
Oh, it can be. You know, really amazing. My favorite things were always big dance numbers with lots mm-hmm. of hair and makeup. I always loved the glam squad and the wardrobe department and, you know, exotic locations. And you can really, you know, get a lot going on and really enjoy yourself. And it can be a collaboration in that you have to bring all these things together so that the director can do something cool.
Right.
You know, the right talent, the right everything.
Yeah, and you're almost the most direct partner of the director, right? The director has to make decisions with you the whole time, right?
Yeah, well, it's more like back-to-back sword fighting. That's what I always call it.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're looking off in their direction, and I'm just trying to complement it as much as I can.
Yeah. It is a partnership that takes care of roles that it also alleviates the director or VFX supervisor in some cases to do their craft as best they can. It was really cool. Okay, so I want to go back to jump around a little bit, but line producer. So a lot of people, I know what a line producer is, but a lot of our audiences come from all kinds of stuff where they're just in school and they don't know what a line producer actually is. Mm-hmm. Tell them what a line producer is.
A line producer is the sort of technical producer on the shoot, and they handle the budget and the issues that are coming up on the shoot. Any technical issues or issues with how to, you know, get the right equipment. They oversee casting. They oversee, you know, bringing talent in front of the director that, you know, will be useful to get the project done. You know, as I said before, the Glam Squad, my favorite director of photography, casting director.
Mostly responsible for the actual shoot, though, right?
Yeah. Usually once photography's wrapped, you're on your way.
Right. So the line producer is sort of like all the details of everything that's happening on the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'll make sure the location's set up, make sure catering is there, make sure you've got the right wardrobe, people, making sure all the call sheets are correct for every day, that everyone who's supposed to be there is there for every time.
The call sheets usually fall down into the, not fall down, but probably more like fall up to the production management team.
Okay.
And then you're dealing with any client side things, because I was mostly only engaged in commercial production.
Right.
There's an agency that could be, you know, 7 to 10 people. There's clients. There's account reps.
Yeah.
There's all kinds
of. It's a lot.
It can be all kinds of. I have to buy a lot of wine.
Yes.
To keep people calm.
You do. And okay, so when I learned about you being a line producer, I worked in commercials, VFX and supervisor in commercials, and that's why I dealt with line producers a lot when I was doing on set. And I always thought it's a valuable person, right? That's a person that's going to make sure everything's going right, and I need to know what's going to be there, right?
Yeah.
If they're a good line producer. And most of the time, I have dealt with really great ones. But I remember when I learned that you were a line producer, all of it clicked to me because of Tron.
Mm-hmm.
On Tron, we were working some really crazy long hours, and it was a really big, important show. And you wanted to make sure that everyone was taken care of, and it wasn't just sort of, you know, nose to the grindstone and just sort of working and working and working. All of a sudden, it's like, all right, we're going to be working late this weekend, but I'm going to get you guys some really kick-ass catering. And we had such good catering that showed up, really good. And then you also had like massage people that would show up, and you had a chiropractor because people obviously were sitting for hours and hours and had back problems or whatever. And you just made sure everyone's happy. And everyone came in. It's like, all right, I got to work on Saturday, but it's really not going to be that bad because Lisa's going to make sure that we're all happy. So I really appreciate it. I remember even once they did a full Thanksgiving dinner for us at one point.
I love doing that.
Yeah.
I love taking care of the artists.
Yeah.
Because they make it happen.
Well, it shows, and you get better results by doing it. It's no secret, you know.
It's the way to do it, and it's not, the percent of the budget is ridiculously small to do a better job of taking care of your artists and give them the gear they need.
Yeah, and your artist's time is way more expensive. So if you keep them dissatisfied or you have them waiting for something, then that's way more of a problem than anything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's really, really interesting. All right. We're going to – so you were at A52. After you did that short film, then is right after that, did you go to A52?
That's when I went to A52.
Was that your first time in post-production?
No, I worked for about 5 years at Rhythm & Hughes.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
For a director named Randy Roberts, who was – incredibly creative. And I started as his production manager, and then I produced for him, I think, for almost 5 years. Mm-hmm. And we went all over the world together. And at the time, Rhythm and Hughes did the editorial and the visual effects and the live action. So they would send me with the director and the visual effects supervisor with very firm instructions not to screw it up.
Okay.
So I had to make sure that we came back with what was needed later, because we did everything.
Sure.
And I would definitely hear about it if we didn't.
Right.
So that was my introduction to visual effects.
Okay.
I was still done at RAP, but I did always really enjoy the visual effects supervisor and, understanding what they needed. And we did a lot of motion control and, everything we did was visual effects.
When was this approximately?
Well, let's see. I think 93
to
98.
So really like the early days of VFX.
Yeah. And, Randy was a master. He had incredible taste in all things, and he was an Art Center graduate,
mm-hmm.
and I adored him, and we had a good run.
And what sort of really attracted you to visual effects as opposed to live action?
Well, I right around that time I had my daughter, and I had my daughter. I was home for 8 weeks, and then I went back to work because they called me and said my maternity leave was over. And I probably should have thought a little bit more about that. But, I went back to work, and there was just so much travel in the commercial business at that time. I was in Italy for a month, then I went to South America, then I was in New Zealand, then I was in Australia, and then I was done because that was, it was too, I just couldn't be away that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I think moved me.
Yeah.
Okay. Out of live action, because I wanted to be home more.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. But it's funny because VFX now, you're going to travel a lot more.
Well, my daughter's graduating from high school tomorrow. And she tells me it's just fine with her. So
good. Well, where's she going
excited.
To school?
She's going to go to LMU.
Oh, nice.
To the theater. She's going to be in the theater program.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's okay.
I'm proud of her.
Good for her. Good for her. Well, at least she'll be close, right?
Yeah, but I won't.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So then you went to A52 for a couple of years, and then after that it was all DD, right?
Yeah. Ed Ulbrich.
Yes.
Hired me, and I think it was 2003.
Okay.
Something like that.
Yeah.
As a freelance producer, I was supposed to just be out of A52 for a little while, but then I came over to DD, and I just totally fell in love with everyone there.
Yeah.
It was just, because it was also just much bigger, so it was a lot more like a commercial,
mm-hmm.
where you could get a project that had, 40 people on it pretty easily if it was a big commercial or more.
Right.
And it felt much more like a commercial size crew to me.
Mm-hmm.
And really exciting.
Because this A52 back then was much smaller, right?
We did a lot of really high-end, title sequences and beautiful arty commercials. But they had a very small, at that time,
mm-hmm.
CG team.
Right.
We did a lot of graphics.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fun.
We work with them a lot nowadays. They're still a big customer of ours. And,
mm-hmm.
Nice guys. I'm really creative.
Incredible.
I love the way that they work with, rock, paper, scissors and mm-hmm. all of that kind of. It's an interesting group. They've been telling me I should stop by there and check them out. But I don't know.
They're amazing people. Linda and Angus, who own A52, are incredible people and, really care about art. And so anytime I find myself.
Yeah, I want to meet Angus. Actually, I would like to have him on the podcast.
You should. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because I had this whole talk was about how they did the Game of Thrones sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool about it, besides it being really creative, is because it's different for every episode because of how they travel to different towns. It's actually an editorial problem, right? They have to figure out how to cut different pieces together. So it's like it's the perfect meld of interesting visual effects, creative stuff with an editorial problem that's solved every week. So mm-hmm. I don't know, I really, very interesting. Anyway, you were at DD in commercials with Ed. This was kind of at 2003 was when commercials was really kind of at the top of its game.
It was pumping.
And lots of really great commercials were being done back mm-hmm. then. I was working in the later 2000s. At the companies that were doing car commercial stuff like Sway and mm-hmm. Method and stuff like that. But DD was like the king of car commercials at that time. And that was, there was a lot of money in car commercials back mm-hmm. then. Really good stuff. Mm-hmm. And so every place you've gone so far, you've mentioned that there was someone that you worked closely with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Someone creative that you bonded with and you guys became like a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And so was that person immediately Eric Barba or did that happen later?
Pretty quickly. I mean, I worked with Fred Raimondi and Les Ecker and I did some live action stuff for them. You know, because they were also trying to do live action, which I think was the attraction they had to me.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, Eric and I hooked up pretty quickly. I'd say within 6 months of me being there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because you obviously, a majority of the stuff that you've done, like I said, the first credit you have on IMDb is Zodiac. So I know that's, you know, obviously an Eric project mm-hmm. and then pretty much everything else after that.
We did the Nine Inch Nails
all right.
video for David Fincher with Trent Reznor that yep. did really well. And we did some commercials with David mm-hmm. Fincher as well. And then, yeah, that rolled into Zodiac.
Right.
Which rolled into
Benjamin Button.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, we also did, it's funny, we talked about it with Janelle.
Mm-hmm.
Because Janelle obviously was also involved.
Yes, very much so.
And so we talked about that, and she's and I've said, and it's like, oh yeah, this story has come up before with Eric, et cetera. And she goes, and then we said, oh, do you want to talk about Orville Redenbacher? He goes, all right, let's talk about Orville Redenbacher, which I think is really cool because she put a really good perspective on Orville because obviously it was very challenging, a lot of criticism about it, but a massive learning experience that Buttons would not have been successful if it wasn't for Redenbacher. So you have to sort of look at those things.
Sometimes you need an embarrassment.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it wasn't. It was not good looking.
I mean, everyone.
It
was
wasn't good looking, but it was. There was a lot of, and she put it down like why she thought it was a challenge or why it was a failure, mm-hmm. why those things happened, which was great because things you do in the beginning, you can't control later. And so you have to live with those decisions. But the next time you start over again, you know what will happen later down the line so you can fix them. And that's obviously what happened on Buttons. But that was really, really cool. I think that was really interesting. But the first time that I worked with you at all was on Tron.
Right.
Yeah. And that was kind of interesting. I sort of immediately noticed. I love – when I'm a VFX supervisor, I always want to work with like the same producer all the time because mm-hmm. I know that the minute you do, you basically have that the way that you can communicate, anticipate things. No, Chris is going to want this, or no, Aaron's not going to want me to do that. That's one of the producers I used to work with all the time, and she was really cool. But I could already sense that you and Eric had that immediately. You'd had that way of communicating where he would push until he knew that. Okay, I pushed Lisa too far on certain things, but you allowed him to be very, very creative. You hardly ever really put a squeeze on anything, which was kind of an interesting way of working, because you did the one thing that I always love is if something's tight, like money's tight or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You find a way to phrase it so that people come up with more creative solutions. You know what I mean?
I didn't know I did that.
Yeah. So that you're like, hey, you know what? We can't do this. So what other cool thing can we do here that's going to be interesting and be more creative? And therefore now, even though you made a decision that's going to save the project or the budget, you know, tons of money, you feel better about it because you've come up with a creative solution at the same time. I remember, like, it happened on Oblivion. You remember Oblivion? We had to, like,
oh yeah,
remember that?
Well, that was just, yeah, it just wasn't possible to do a good job with resources in Vancouver. And when we did the math, we realized it could happen,
right,
with really senior, wonderful artists in LA, and still be able to write a check for the rebate.
Right.
I mean, I don't know that the studio liked the change, but we did deliver incredible work, I think. And
well, what you told me is you came up to me in the office and you showed me your big board and you said, all right, see this? We have about 20 people here. Now, if you can get whichever artists you want, no matter who it is, no matter what, how few of these can you do it with? And the problem was that Vancouver was overbooked. There was not enough artists over there. There was just, you know, everything had to go to Vancouver, and we just didn't have enough artists up there. So,
well, the rebate is, you know, just really popular for obvious reasons, because it helps movies get made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I stripped my lighting crew down to like 5 or 6 people, really small. And I felt good about it. I didn't feel like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to do it with 5 or 6 people. I was like, no. If I have the guys I know and trust and really good guys, then it was going to work. And you made me feel like this is going to be great. I'm going to have the best people ever, as opposed to saying, sorry, you have to do it with 1/3 of the people. You actually made me feel good about making those decisions.
Well, it worked, because really good people are worth 3 regular people.
Right. Although Eric did give me a thing. He said you should make sure you get at least 1 or 2 good interns, because you always have to keep a fresh crop of people that are learning or find out what's going on. And
yeah, I have 2 right now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, on Ready Player One.
Interns in the production side of things?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I like them, too. I believe that, too.
Yeah. I do too. I normally love interns. I love sort of the mentorship thing, but I've had some interns recently, and I don't know what it is, but maybe, it wasn't that recently, but maybe it's just the whole millennial thing sometimes. You know what I mean? I hate to say it, millennials, but sometimes it's like you come in and you're like, I don't understand. I went to school, and therefore I should be a superstar right now, right from the start. It's like, well, God. You know how long I had to work to get to where I am? And so they just, sometimes they just don't get it. But that's okay. They're all talented. They're all very smart. It's just there's a sense of entitlement that sometimes I was like, yeah. So I'm not as excited as I used to be about interns. But I'm sure I'll find some good ones.
You will. Keep trying.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So what was some of your greatest memories of DD? Because obviously I think the Oblivion, and then we did Girl with Dragon Tattoo. We did a bunch of things. 47 yeah. Ronin, that was crazy.
Yeah. I don't know. I think my memories of DD are, you know, just how many amazing people are there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'll ever forget the day that was one of the first days I was there, and we were in the old commercials building on Main Street in Venice, and we went into the warehouse area and into one of the conference rooms there, and it was just an overwhelming blast of like gym stench. Just all these people, you know, we had the double decker all the way around the outside, and
it's all plywood and
those
2x4s.
Plywood and I just thought, oh my God, I can't even take a breath in. And, you know, a few weeks later, I don't think I ever even noticed that smell again.
Right.
And just, you know, walking around and talking to all the artists, just, you know, everyone was an individual and so cool in their own right. And everyone's well-read and funny, or, you know, has a good bottle of scotch. It's just, you know, such an array. And I was in such mad love that that's why I was there for so long.
It definitely feels like there was a lot of individuality, right? Mm-hmm. I think one of the places where there was the most celebration of your individuality, if you wanted to be that person you could be that person, mm-hmm. and people would respect you for it or mock you for it or whatever it was going to be, but you would be allowed to be that person.
Yeah, a real celebration of out of the box.
Yeah.
Behaviors, solutions.
Yep.
You know, and I guess one of my, you know, I always remember meeting Nikos Kalatzidis for the first time and working with him. He was such a hoot. And Steve Prieg, when we started The Curious Case of Benjamin Button,
yep.
showing up in my office one day, shifting from foot to foot, you know, mm-hmm. about how we were going to get the development approved before the award to make sure we could make those heads right. properly. You know, just getting to work with him on that and just, yeah, it's really just all about the artists.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I think that DD has always, and we mentioned this before, at least Sally Slade was on and mm-hmm. We talked about her coming to DD and what it was like when she first started there. And it's not an uncommon theme. DD has a great ability of looking at people that other people might have looked by mm-hmm. and finding those people and making them like, oh, there's something special. And to be honest, I'm in the same case. No one was going to hire me at DD. DD was the only place that considered me, only because there was one person that was able to speak out and say, I think this person will make it.
And look, like, how amazing you were. You saved our ass over and over again.
Well, that was many years later. But I mean, you know, it was specifically, what was his name? Andy Waisler. Do you remember Andy Waisler? He's actually J.J. Abrams. I think he's J.J. Abrams' brother-in-law.
Wow.
And he's actually an ex-architect and went uh-huh. back to architecture. And by the way, he also designed Bad Robot's office. Really, but he was.
I hear it's really cool.
It's really cool. Yeah. It's a nerd land in heaven. It's like an orgasm of nerdism everywhere. But he was an ex-architect, and I was an architect at the time. And so they were interviewing me, and you know, we'd look at my resume, and like I got some renderings of buildings. I didn't really have that much animation because back then animation was really hard to do in architecture because didn't have that many computers or resources. But I had a couple of things. And but I've been doing it for many years, and a lot of people are like, "Nah, he doesn't really have production experience." And Andy's like, "No," because he was a CG supervisor. He's like, "No. He gets it. You just have to help him make that transfer." It's like, "Okay, now you're not doing buildings; you're doing this, and then just transfer." He's like, "He totally gets it," and it was only because he took a chance on me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a few people that helped put my demo reel on top, but. That was never would have happened. I think DD has that ability to say, huh, you know, that person is good. I'll mm-hmm. find out. You know who actually was really good at that was Darren Grant.
Yeah.
Darren Grant had the ability of finding some random person at some random part of the globe and saying, that person, let's hire that one. And then so many of the interns that he has hired has turned big things. Several of them have won Oscars. And so – really kind of
yeah, I love how that all kind of comes together and it's like a big melting pot.
Yeah.
And it's different from live action because live action is on a very expensive daily schedule.
Oh, yeah, you do your job.
Whereas visual effects has, you know, has time to be more of a melting pot.
Uh-huh.
And I always really enjoyed that. I do enjoy that
very much. Who's your favorite department in the visual effects? Like, is it the modeling, the lighting, the compositors? Probably the compositors.
Oh, God. I love... There is no, they're just all, there's just amazing people in every department.
Yeah.
I don't have I like my supervisors usually because that's who I get to spend the most time with.
Right. Yep.
So.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in your office just sitting down venting. Help.
I get to spend the most time with them and that's really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see. I want to talk to you about something else that's come up, and this has been a kind of a goal of mine. There's one of the things that happened when I was started this podcast is one of our Gina was saying, it's like, you don't have many women on your podcast. I was like, no, it's actually, I don't have any women on my podcast. And this is a very strange thing. So I said, my goal is to have more women on podcasts and find out more why there's not more women available to do on my podcast. In fact, I got a comment on one of them. One with Janelle, someone said that this is bullshit because I work with women all the time in visual effects. And it's like, yeah, you do, but there's not that many of them. And there's certainly not that many of them that are in a supervisor position, right? Mm-hmm. Very few women in a supervisor position. And it's not, I don't think anyone is being overtly sexist or putting down. I just think it's the way things happen that it's harder for women to be in a supervisor position. But that's not the case on the production side of things. So producers, coordinators, et cetera, vastly more women than men in that area. In fact, it's completely flopped in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Why?
Because we're mothers.
Is that what it is?
Maybe.
You think so? I mean, I definitely think so. But is that really what it is?
I think women can spin a lot of plates because... Maybe because we're mothers, maybe not. Maybe our brains are wired a little differently. And, you know, sometimes I come across guys who are like that, who can spin a lot of plates. But mostly I don't.
Okay.
And I hope no one gets insulted by that. But, you know, I work with a producer, Steve Wan, and I'm always teasing him about his girl-like precision and everything he does. And there's nothing girlish about him, but his brain just...
He has that ability.
He has that producer brain, you know, where he can think about 25 different things and keep them all in the air and add five more and take two away. And
I completely agree. And I know that's part of my problem, why I probably won't be a good producer, even though I like the challenge when I'm working on IRL, is I don't have that ability. In fact, one of the biggest things I want with my current job is I need a coordinator or a producer or someone to help figure out all the plates that I'm spinning. Because I got all these ideas, but I don't know how to keep them all balanced. You know, I can work on them a little bit here and there, but I've always had good experiences with that specific thing. But I think that there's something about it also with when I was working in architecture, they didn't have producers back then, but they had the women bosses in the architecture field were very good at getting the best out of you.
Maybe project managers, right? Because don't architect offices that are building things?
Yeah, they're more project manager, but they were also the best at sort of convincing you to do your do your job. They were encouraging. I guess it was nurturing.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, right? So there's one thing about balancing everything. Obviously, you have, you know, everything that's going on, but you also seem to nurture that process really well. Coordinators too. Like coordinators, some of the women coordinators are very different. I have men coordinators and female coordinators, and they're very good at making sure, check mark. But women coordinators are way better at making sure we stay on schedule that I found than certain men do. There's a certain thing about the schedule that seems to work better.
I don't know. What do you think it is? Because I really don't know.
I that's what I'm trying to figure out. I'm also just, you know, there's like I said, there's been very few women who are actually in that. Most of the women I know in it in visual effects are in the production side of things. In fact, the joke about, you know, romance that happens in visual effects, it's usually a male artist and a female coordinator that get together with some kind of a relationship.
Don't tell HR.
But it's usually that's the way it is, right? So, I mean, it's in the sense that you see more women on the production side of things. The only exception to that, and this is my persona, is compositing. And I believe that the reason that you see more women in compositing is physiological, because women have a better ability, women are see color better than men do.
Yeah, some of the most sensitive compositors like Kim Olsen or Janelle Croshaw when she was doing that, or Sonia Burchard is incredible, just not at DD anymore. Yeah, we have some really, really good women in that field. Not a lot in effects,
I've seen a couple women in effects. Not that many animators that are women. texture artists, definitely more texture artists. But again, that's a color thing, right? They're able to understand colors better. I truly say this, and I'm not trying to generalize, but I think that there's really a physiological reason why women are better at working in colors. And you see women lighters, those are because it's closely related to color issues. But the Janelles, let's just put it that way, mm-hmm. are rare, right? Mm-hmm. The Janelles, there's a lot of great female compositors that get to a certain point, right? That they're really good senior leadership compositors, well-paid, well-respected in their field. But very few of them go to the Janelle where they actually become a visual effects supervisor and tell people what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard.
So I don't know why that is.
Yeah.
Because my wife works in the industry too, and there's been discussion that basically, while they don't necessarily see it overtly, men have a harder time taking direction from women.
Yeah, I've seen that. Sure. Yeah, but, I've seen that.
And I don't think they mean it. It's a different tone. Like, women have to ask people nicely to do things as opposed to say, just fix it.
Yes, definitely. I agree.
So, but at the same time, like when we're dealing with I guess women in the production side of things, it's different. You don't necessarily, because you're not going around telling artists to fix things all the time.
No.
You're asking, can you please stay late?
Here's some dinner. Can you stay late?
Right.
Maybe, yeah. I think you're right. It when you're trying to get a bunch of guys to do things that they don't agree with, and as you know, and you can probably explain better in visual effects, you know, to me it's like, you know, a beautiful orchestra playing, mm-hmm. and there's so many different instruments and there are the different departments, and if someone is discordant and you have to straighten them out and you have to kind of straighten them out quickly.
Yeah.
Because they're hurting all the other, you know, they're hurting the music that needs to come out. You know, it's true. I've worked with male VFX supervisors who can, you know, snap people too. And,
right.
And of course, I've worked with Janelle and I've watched her struggle sometimes. And, you know, it seems a little unfair.
She's doing really well now.
Yeah, she just did something together at DD.
Yeah. She's
with Mark Forster. Did she tell you about it?
She did.
Yeah.
She did.
Very difficult, creative, you know, supposed to be never before seen effects,
right.
Which is always really scary.
But that's
the scariest thing you'll ever hear.
Yeah.
Or a place we've never seen before. That's the other really scary one.
Or I love the ones where they give you a direction where they say a word and then everyone has a different interpretation of what that word actually mm-hmm. means. Mm-hmm. I did a commercial where it's like, all right, so the sunroof opens and then there's a vortex that sucks something in. It's like, okay, you just used the word vortex. Everyone had a complete different vision in their mind of what that vortex.
Some and even more
tornado,
scary, the word something.
Oh, something. Something happens.
That really got my producer antennas standing up.
Wait a minute. Yeah.
What something is that?
Yeah. I had a executive producer who would hand me a sheet of paper and say, okay, you've been doing this car commercial. And the only thing it said on the car commercial was, here's $200,000. Do a 30-second car commercial. There was no other contingencies. Like, I don't even know what they want. How can I do it for $200,000 of what? What? Something. Yeah. What is some of your favorite parts of producing?
I love it all.
Yeah,
I do. I like the initial contact with the clients, and I like bidding, and I love making the plan with the supervisors to, you know, once we have a bid and an idea of what the clients have to spend and when they need it by. I love the planning part. And, you know, organizing, you know, doing the org charts and pie charts and every kind of chart to, I'm a big data person. I have a supervisor who's like, you like the data, don't you?
Yeah.
Because I do think it really tells you something. So I love that. And then of course, I love the people, which I've told you a couple times.
Yeah, and but do you, what about, okay, but you mentioned the client side. So that's a little bit different, right? So dealing with clients, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of politics that goes on there, right?
Yeah.
Like you even mentioned a little bit on Oblivion, there was a tough thing. You had to make a decision, obviously, and like it's going to affect how things are getting done.
How we're perceived.
How you proceed. Yeah. What they, you know, so that's a tough role. How's that changed over the years that you've witnessed?
Well, for me, I've just learned that the clients, they just need to have the best time possible.
Uh-huh.
And that you spend a lot of time building trust, which is the most important thing you can do.
Yep.
Because once people can, you know they can trust you, then they can listen to you without suspicion and you can solve problems together, because visual effects is at the end of the line. It's tremendously expensive, mm-hmm. and people just want it over. But, you know, by the time they get to you, they're over it.
Yeah, they've done shooting the film like a year ago.
And there's finite funding left, and it can be incredibly stressful,
right.
Especially on really big movies. And I've just learned by making doing a lot of stupid things, you know, now I do less of them because I've been doing it for a while.
Sure. But,
you know, the most important thing is to have trust.
Okay.
And that takes a while, but, and to have a good time and to not, you know, freak out too much.
Right. So, but
people appreciate you for that later.
Of course. Of course. But you've done, obviously you've gotten a lot of trust with people like David Fincher, mm-hmm. right? And so he's come back. He's like, he knows that you're going to go.
He knows my last name. But
really?
No, I'm just kidding. No, Sion, and you know his Peter Mavromatis, whom I've worked with on all of his movies.
Uh huh.
You know, David's more of the creative person, and he's incredible to watch work, and he's so irreverent and funny, and I've always adored him.
Right.
We don't see enough of him these days, but.
Yeah.
And then we had Joe Kaczynski, who
yep.
also trusted us.
Yep. Yeah.
So
Joe's, and it's cool. You know, Joe at the same time, he recognized the crew, right? He wasn't one of those directors that was sort of behind the curtain and only spoke to his producer or whatever. He saw it as being part of that process.
Well, he came in, you know, through Ed Ulbrich into our commercial division, and we did a lot of commercials with mm-hmm. him. Before Tron.
Right.
So we had a relationship with him.
Okay. Yeah. And was that Eric's? Eric was doing those as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, Joe was connected in some way to David Fincher.
They were both at Anonymous
yeah.
back in the day.
And I think David thought he was, you know, kind of neat and cool and brought him up to Ed Ulbrich and mm-hmm. and then, you know, said we should try to help.
Yep.
You know, he was always sort of big on that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I liked working with Joe for sure. It would be
super cool guy.
Super cool guy.
Yeah.
What's he doing recently? I know there was several things that came and went and, how much we can actually talk about, but
yeah, he's doing something. Eric is doing something with him in New Mexico.
Oh, really?
And luckily I don't know the name of it, so I can't inappropriately tell you right now.
Is it a feature or is it a commercial?
I'm sure it's publicized somewhere. It's a movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
In New Mexico.
I think they're shooting some of it there.
Okay.
Well, that's cool. I just know Eric was there last time I spoke to him.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So I guess we should talk about the fact that Eric is no longer a DD, as you know, and then you are leaving DD as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I resigned a couple weeks ago. And
okay.
I'll be leaving. My last day will be July 1st.
Yeah, that's my daughter's birthday.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I've been able to have a better life with my family staying there. And I've always, you know, gotten way more than I've given just because of, you know, the artists are so amazing.
Sure.
But it's, you know, time to try something else.
Yeah. Can you say what you're doing on the air?
I can't yet, but
okay.
It's super exciting.
That's great.
And I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunity.
But you're continuing in the producing side of things.
Yes,
we can
yeah.
say that at
mm-hmm,
least. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. What are you looking forward to most for in the future?
I don't know, seeing how long I can last.
Yeah.
Less, you know, it takes a lot of energy. As you know, we all give a lot of energy into movie making.
You were never one of those like nervous producers. I've never seen you nervous. I've seen you angry. Well, I've seen you upset, like it's like, oh, we're never gonna get it done, or like, I told you so, this is not gonna work, or whatever. But I've never seen you just, I don't know what to do, I'm gonna panic. And I've seen a lot
frustrated,
of
you get frustrated. I think that's the word for me.
I've never seen you nervous though.
No, I'm not terribly nervous.
Yeah.
It's all probably inside, which is probably not good.
But okay.
I don't think it's good to, you know, let a big group of people see you flipping out. That's never helpful.
Yeah. No, it's not. And it doesn't instill confidence, right? No. The whole point is to make people feel like everything is going to be okay.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's cool. All right. Well, we're actually a little bit short on time, but I was wondering if there anything else you want to talk about, you can think about.
I don't know.
Yeah. What was some of your favorite shows or memories you can think of, Aditi?
Favorite memories that, other than those that I've already spoken of.
Talking about Nikos, that was fun. What was some of your favorite things on Tron?
Tron. Oy.
That was a big show. That was a huge show.
I think that was the first time I had an executive turn around and say to me, could you stop making it good? Could you just make it viewable? Could you stop everyone from making it so cool? That was interesting.
Why did they say that? Because it was just so much.
I don't know. I was pinned up against the wall after a dailies, after a review, after a client.
Oh, right.
I think we were on probably, I don't know if you remember the shot of the recognizer flying in and landing. I think we were probably on version 325 or something like that.
I could see that. I had one of those. I had one of those shots. What was the shot? It was a shot when it was on the underside and the light bike when it crashed into the wall and it flipped over.
Oh,
and I'd been working on that. I think it was the first shot I started, and it was one of the last shots to final. And I think I was close to 200 versions on that one.
Yeah, in that kind of a movie, we had so many things to break the cherry on, right? But once we did, we could make 50 more.
Yeah.
It just might have taken us 3 or 4 months to make one.
Yep.
But then 2 weeks later, here's 50 more.
Yeah. But it ended up being, I mean, I liked working on Tron. It was tough, though.
It was a hard show, but you know what? I feel like it did get organized. It was my first movie of that size, and, you know, it was really hard for me, too. I think I was on a heart monitor in the last month of that movie.
Really?
Yeah, just, you know, from exhaustion and the stress of, you know, because we were managing a lot of outsourced vendors and we had,
Janelle and I were in Toronto, remember?
Yeah, we were sending people everywhere and we had 900 shots internally, but I do feel like we did make a doable plan and we stuck to it and we did deliver on time. And there was only that one last night where we stayed up all night, and I'll never forget Natasha Ozu's had these incredibly high wooden heels on with these giant plastic flowers. And I was laying on the floor of the screening room while we were waiting for shots to come in from Vancouver and just watching those flowers all night. And then we all went out to breakfast at, I don't know, 6 or 7 in the morning.
Yep.
After staying up all night.
Yeah. In the screening room.
Yeah, but that was our only all-nighter, so I think that's not too bad.
Yeah. I mean, you get that towards the end, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I remember there was something that happened on one shot that had been a problem shot for a long time, and it ended up being one of the artists we worked on that screwed up but didn't tell me why. And so we finally figured out why it was looking bad. And it's like, I can't believe you've been doing that the whole time. And it happened right as we as we were supposed to be celebrating. I think we hadn't quite gone to the beach and done our whole dinner at the beach or lunch at the beach yet. But there was the food trucks. Remember, there was food trucks and there was hot dogs coming and stuff like that. And Nico said, "Chris, you're the only person that can fix this." I said, "I know." And then people were having beers and hot dogs and cheering and dancing and singing. And so he says, I will bring you all the hot dogs and beer to your desk if you can fix these shots for me. And I was so angry. I was like, I'm supposed to be celebrating. He's like, fine, I'll fix the shots. So, yeah, but those are fun.
And I think you were proud, right, of that work? I think at the time it was very good, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot of problems you guys had to solve.
Yeah. It was the first big V-Ray show that was done there.
We switched over the dramatic moment when we said, no, we are not doing mental ray.
Yeah.
Remember that? Oh, boy, we lost a few good soldiers there, but it was the right decision.
I think it was, in the end, it was the right decision. Obviously, I hate to say it, but Dee Dee had a little bit of foresight in that area because obviously a lot of people have switched over since then. It's an ongoing trend. They either use, Arnold or V-Ray or whatever, but mental ray is just not necessarily what it used to be. It may continue to be at some point when NVIDIA decides to put more money into it. But at that time, I think it was the right decision. It obviously was the decision that brought me back to Dee Dee as well. I think that was one of the reasons Eric wanted me there. And I enjoyed that part. I enjoyed the challenge of it.
And it looked beautiful. It did the trick.
Yep. Yeah.
And efficiently.
I just come from doing a bunch of car commercials, and then I went on the light bike sequence, which was basically another car commercial. But I do remember having fun. But I remember it was tough. That was a huge show, and it was a big serious show that we were working on. And it was my first time working with Eric, and Eric was very forceful with me because he had never worked with me before. So he kind of very opinionated, right? And then it wasn't until after that that Eric and I sort of created a relationship or a communication of trust, right? So I do remember that. But I remember several other shows after that, another really cool one that I loved. I kind of really like working. We didn't do that much on it. It was really short, but it was the girl with the dragon tattoo stuff. That was a lot of fun.
We did quite a bit, actually.
Well, we did. But
we touched a lot of that.
We did the whole bridge sequence and the bike sequence. Those are, again, really simple. We had only a handful of people. I think Tim Nassauer and Daniel Buck and a couple other people.
The greats.
Yeah. They were all involved. I was like, this is going to be easy because we've got the best guys on it. Juan Gomez, too.
Yeah. My God, Juan. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was some great that I really liked doing that, and that's when I was like, I can be with this team. It was the Lisa Eric team. I could be with them for every show. Anytime they want me on a show, I'm totally there, totally there. So obviously Oblivion was there. 47 Ronin was not necessarily the greatest thing, and that was not a Eric show, but it had nothing to do with it. I think it was just the fact that when it worked, Jay was great. But we did the thing, and then we sat there and we had to wait because we didn't know if the sequence was actually going to be in the movie or not.
Yeah, I think and this is something I've avoided ever since, especially because a lot of the work was combination work, was we were finished so much earlier than the movie was finished. And
right.
Other facilities, was it MPC? Yeah, it was MPC who had a lot of the movie that was in flux. And so they went on for months afterwards, and then the work continues to develop. And then suddenly your work isn't really holding up. And then
it looks different.
Yeah, it looks different, right, or whatever. It moves on. It continues to, what's that word I'm looking for? Evolve. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly everyone's pissed off at you, even though they were perfectly fine.
Nothing has changed in 6 months.
but everything was finaled, and it was, okay. I try to avoid letting that happen as a producer.
Yeah.
Ever since. If I see that happening, my antennas go up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I say, hey, let's start later if this is going to happen.
Yeah.
If possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
What are you seeing the trends in terms of VFX these days, in terms of budgets and all stuff? Obviously, we already are very familiar with tax rebates based on geography, but what are some of the other trends you're seeing? Are you seeing more things like, obviously, a lot more fixed bids and things of that nature?
I haven't been at DD seeing that, but you see everything broken up into little pieces.
Uh-huh.
Whereas, Tron, we did the whole movie, Ender's Game, we did the whole movie. And
we outsourced it ourselves.
We manage the outsourcing. And I think, you know, places like ILM are still getting to do that, and probably MPC. But, you know, I've just witnessed, you know, here are your 300 shots. And then you have several of those movies going on.
And you have to work with other studios.
And it's, you know, yeah.
I think they mentioned on Avengers, the last Avengers, that there were 20 studios that were working on that.
20 vendors? Yeah. Wow, that sounds right. And yeah.
So you're saying that's a new trend? Why do you think that's happening?
I think truncated deliveries, you know, work needs to happen quickly. You know, something gets shot and you do really need a lot of time to cut something and think about it. And, you know, it tends to be limited to 8 to 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. An editorial, and then, you know, the director needs that time, and then the studio needs the time to react,
right,
and see how they're feeling about how the story's coming together. And, you know, before you know it, the time for visual effects is, you know, just getting shorter and shorter.
Right.
So I think that might be one of the reasons.
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting. Someone was telling me that they think that that's happening because the studios just don't have enough trust in a single studio to pull something off. And that there's been too many studios that are operating on low margins, that if they put all their eggs in one basket, they can't distribute the work.
I buy that too.
But I also think it's just, there's just too many visual effects and they're all huge. You know, like, let's take the Avengers as an example. That's probably like 2,500 shots that were all visual effects, right?
I'm sure. Yeah, probably big, yeah.
And that's just not sustainable for a single studio to do all of that and control all of that. So it makes sense, I guess. But anyway, that was really cool. I really appreciate you coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Cool to have you here. Thank you, Tiffany, for coming too.
Yeah, Tiffany, thank you.
But we will be posting this at some later time, probably after you leave. So if there's anything else you want to let us know, I'll usually do the introduction before, and I can tell people, you know, what's going on, so that people can hear that, if that sounds good. So we'll figure that out.
Okay.
But give my best to everyone, Didi. You still got a couple of weeks there left, so please give my best to everyone there. And let them know that I'd love to see them and hang out. And if anyone else wants to be on the podcast, Tiffany, let me know, okay? If anything cool happens. All right. Thanks, guys. I'm going to let the last bucket drop, and we'll see you guys later.